I'm glad to be back. And, you know, I'm still not going to give you a percentage of all the books I sell.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we'll keep trying.
Why don't we do a UFO show only with people who know something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice. It's always something new. What keeps me going is I enjoy doing shows like this. I enjoy the feeling of educating the public. And I'll admit I enjoy when I can recognize walking in a supermarket. For anybody who's listening to think that you get paid, they all pay me what you pay me, Tim. You finally made it, huh? You gotta have, like, Bill Nye, the science guy whose purpose is to deny.
I love that. That's great.
They say, Stan, look, let him have him on all the time. He makes you look good.
Forget the Nobel Prize winner. Just give you the Nobel Prize already. That's what I'm saying.
I'll take it. I'll take it. You're really putting on one heck of a show.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays!
Ho, 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 my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with the 6th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. First of all, happy holidays to everybody out there. Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, happy Kwanzaa, and happy New Year's. What the hell, we'll throw it in there, even though you're going to be hearing from us before the 31st. It's a Festivus for the rest of us. It is the BOA Audio Holiday Special. Every year I look forward to this episode. It is truly one of my favorite installments of the program each season. Talking about the Holiday Special here with Stanton Friedman. And it really has turned into more than just a celebration of the holidays. It has become really a celebration of the man himself, the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman. I hold Stanton Friedman in the highest regards, as anybody who's listened to the program knows. There are so many ufologists out there. There are so many people who have done fantastic work. But Stanton Friedman is one of the very, very few that have transcended the world of UFOs. You could walk down the street of any city or town in the world and just say Roswell, and the people there will know exactly what you're talking about. That really, folks, is the result of the work of Stanton Friedman. He's changed the very fabric of the global culture. And when you stop to think about that, that is a stunning thing to realize. And that's why we celebrate him each year here on the BOA Audio Holiday Special. This year's Festivus is going to be a very entertaining affair because it is jam-packed with stuff. Much like the last 2 years, we opened up the floor to BOA Audio listeners, and we got a ton of questions. I'll get to those in just a minute. Let me give you a thumbnail overall of what we're going to be discussing here on the 6th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. We'll start by getting Stan to reflect on the recent Exeter UFO Festival, where I had the chance to introduce him for the packed crowd. And then we'll get into some discussion on his new book, Science Was Wrong. Then we'll look at UFO organizations and the internet. And we'll get him to weigh in on the retirement of Larry King. That's sort of the prelude. That's kind of like the appetizer, if you will, because then we open up the mailbag and we begin doling out the questions from BOA Audio listeners for the father of modern-day ufology. This year, we're going to pose over 15 diverse queries submitted by listeners, and we've got some questions from former BOA Audio guests Greg Bishop, Jason Offit, and Keith Chester. So that's something a little bit different and a surprise to me. They just joined in alongside all the other folks who submitted questions, and I was really touched that they wanted to take part in this year's proceedings. I'm not going to go over all the topics from the listener questions, but here's sort of a little overview. We're going to hear about the electric universe theory, hypnosis and abductions, including the recent Emma Woods case, how a modern-day Roswell might go down. We'll get Stan's opinion on the face on Mars, UFOs in the media, the ETs are from inner Earth theory, and the ETH, as well as how he would have handled having J. Allen Hynek's job at Project Blue Book. And that's just a handful of the questions we're going to be getting to. This really is a veritable Stanton Friedman press conference here from the BOA Audio listeners. They just got a ton of stuff in, including really some truly personal and existential areas of discussion that I think you're going to find particularly enlightening, because I sure did. Our tagline for this one had been, it's the holiday special you do not want to miss, but chances are you're not going to miss it because you're listening to me right now. So just kick back, throw on the Yule log, because it's time for our annual fireside chat with the iconic Stanton Friedman. There's not much more to say beyond that, so happy holidays, my friends. Let me give you the brief overview of Stanton Friedman's bio. He, of course, received his BS and MS degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956, then spent the next 14 years working as a nuclear physicist for some serious powerhouse companies on advanced, classified, and eventually canceled projects like nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. Then, of course, he delved into the world of ufology, and over the course of his remarkable career as a ufologist, he has provided written testimony for congressional hearings, appeared twice at the UN. He's been a pioneer in many aspects of ufology, including Roswell, Majestic 12, and the Betty Hill Marjorie Fish star map work. He really has become the face of ufology over the last 30 years. He's the author of Top Secret Magic, Crash at Corona, and his magnum opus, Flying Saucers and Science, as well as the co-author of Captured, and his latest book, also co-authored with Kathleen Martin, titled Science Was Wrong. His website is www.stantonfriedman.com. Easy stuff there, folks. Stantonfriedman.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and start unwrapping. This interview was recorded on December 12th, 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, the 6th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special, featuring Stanton Friedman. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 6th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. You really don't need me to say much more than that because, of course, you know who the guest is. He's been on the program here every year on the final episode before Christmas. He is beyond a legend in the world of ufology. He is a true icon. The author of Crash at Corona, Top Secret Magic, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which he co-authored with Kathleen Martin, his magnum opus, Flying Saucers and Science, and his latest book, also co-authored with Kathleen Martin, Science Was Wrong. He is the legendary Stanton Friedman, and it is, you know, always a thrill for me to talk to him. He was the very first interview that I ever did. We like to give Jim Morris credit for planting the seed for my interest in the esoteric, but when it comes to Stan Friedman, he really opened the door for me to continue onward here and develop this into a radio show. And without him, you know, if he had told me to get the hell out of here back at the X conference in 2004, there would be no Banal of America Audio. So we owe a huge debt to him, and that's why we celebrate him here every year on the BOA Audio Holiday Special. Welcome back to the program, Stan, and happy holidays.
Well, I'm glad to be back, and, you know, I'm still not going to give you a percentage of all the books I sell.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we'll keep trying every year, I guess. Well, you can always lay claim to the fact that I think you're the only person in all of ufology that has his own holiday special. So, you know, that you got that going
yeah,
for
you're
too.
You're right about that. Hanukkah we're celebrating, right?
There you go. Absolutely. Yes. All holidays here on the holiday special. Now, I had the unique pleasure of working with you and introducing you at the Exeter event this past September, and I was really sort of blown away by
just how beloved you were by the crowd. I mean, I should have known this because of all the emails I get and how, you know, how high I hold you in esteem. But just, it was stunning to me how packed the place was and how fervent the crowd was and excited for you. I mean, what does that feel like for you to just have them in the palm of your hand? Like, you went up there to check your slides and they wouldn't let you get off the stage. It was that amazing. It was something I've never quite seen before. So, you know, what's that like for you?
It was great. And, you know, what was most interesting to me at Exeter, you know, it's not a big town. And I was, of course, pleased with the size of the crowd. But what surprised me is how many books went out the door. From the time I got there and set up shop outside with Kathleen, who was there, we ran out of books. And, you know, that rarely happens. And we're talking a small town, you know. And we had, because I came by car, I live up in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, which is, you know, 400 and some miles from Exeter. And so it's drivable. I don't do it in the winter very often, but for obvious reasons. But so I drove down and I picked up cases of books at my office in Maine across the border. And I was shocked by the sales just went on and on and on. I thought, you know, there'd be a few sales beforehand and quite a few after the lecture and so forth. But to me, when people put their money where their mouth is, that's something special. And so I felt very pleased. I wasn't at the year ago's conference, but this one certainly pleased me. And, you know, I'll tell you, I did get an enthusiastic crowd a few weeks ago down in Baltimore, but it was smaller, only a couple hundred. And this is an international, global something or other group, younger people, and I couldn't believe it. When each of the four speakers was introduced, they stood and clapped and cheered, and when we finished, they stood and clapped and cheered. I've never seen that kind of enthusiasm. They must have been programmed, you know. But Exeter was a very good experience, and, you know, I haven't written much about the incident at Exeter, but, of course, John Fuller, who wrote the book Incident at Exeter, is the one who wrote the first book about the Betty and Barney Hill case. So, and I'm sure a lot of those people, I know a lot of those people bought Captured, which is, what, from 65 to 2007, that's, what, 42 years later, and the interest is still there. That tells you something, you know, for those people who say, oh, nobody cares about flying saucers, or I have to tell you, I'm getting ready to do my column for the MUFON Journal, and I want to do it on aliens and the media, because we've had the strange experience the last couple months of seeing a lot of notes about aliens, but not visiting extraterrestrials, you know.
Yeah.
Arsenic and old aliens, arsenic and old life.
I like that, yeah.
And reading, I was looking up extremophiles and extraterrestrial life on Google just to see what they say, and the one on extraterrestrial life, there's a couple of page introduction and stuff. And they finish with, like, two sentences saying, there are those people who think some UFOs are alien spacecraft, but that's discounted by the scientific community, which knows that they're mistaken airplanes and astronomical objects. And, you know, it just dismissed it right out of hand. And, you know, I looked up to give people a sense of perspective here. I looked up gold mining, gold ore, and it used to be that gold ore was worth mining if there was an ounce of gold per ton of ore.
Oh, wow.
And I looked up an article now. Of course, that's when the price of gold was a lot less than it is now. And it said that with some of the special cyanide processes, it's worth mining the stuff if there's a gram of gold per ton of ore.
Wow.
A gram! So, you know, be generous. Give them 50 grams. We're still talking a very tiny percentage of the ore is gold, but it's worth mining. Now, in the biggest study ever done, 21.5% of the sightings couldn't be explained, and apparently that's not worth mining, which I find extraordinary. And, of course, the guy doesn't – none of the references deal with UFOs. There's a whole long list of references at the end of this long article, and, you know – Who are these idiots who are writing this junk? Well, you think... They're so afraid, and that's what has characterized all the coverage. And incidentally, I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's been a strong backlash to that article about arsenic replacing phosphorus in the bacteria out at Mono Lake, you know, which they made a big deal about.
Yeah.
An article in Science Magazine, and Felicia Simon something or other made all the television stations and all that stuff. And there have been a couple of backlash articles saying that article should never have been published. The science was wrong, and they didn't mention this, that, and the other thing, and a strong reaction to it. I was a little surprised, but it is interesting that it's okay to talk about that. And something else that got the attention of the media recently was the discovery of a planet in a Goldilocks zone, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people talking about for sure there's life out there. And you sit back and say, wait a minute. We don't know what the surface of that planet is like. We know roughly the mass and the size. Now, Venus is not very different from Earth, but the circumstances on the surface are certainly very, very different.
Exactly.
Like 600 degrees, you know, and sulfuric acid. Not a nice place for an Earthling to visit, I'll tell you that. But we act... it's the ego that's getting in the way here, you know? We're surprised that there's a form of life that we didn't know about, because we know everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What nonsense! The whole idea of science is to discover what you didn't know before. It's based on a presumption that there is information to be learned. We're not at the acme. We're not in a position where we can say, well, we've discovered it all. You know, close the patent office, there's nothing more to be discovered kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And the arrogance that comes with that is really something else, which I find laughable. It's not funny laughable, but it's odd. It's weird. It's arrogant. It's egotistical. It's really the work of an ignoramus to suggest that how could there be a form of life that we don't know about? Holy cow. Where does that come from?
Yeah, it makes you wonder. It goes back almost to, you know, part of the human condition or something, because, you know, there was such steadfast resistance to Copernicus and his ideas.
Yeah.
You know, it's been going on
forever.
Poor
old Giordano Bruno. Boy, did he take it in the neck. Well, he got burned at the stake. I don't know where he got burned. But, yeah, you know, and I was reading I learned something, that the Talmud apparently someplace says that there are 18,000 other worlds out there. I didn't know it said that. I've got to look that one up.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, it was only with the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe that would rule out anything else being out there, boy. And, gee, you know what? That isn't true.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We know better. Well, that's a good segue into the new book, Science Was Wrong, as I said, co-written with Kathleen Martin. What's been the reaction from the scientific community to the book, if at all? Because, I mean, they seem like the types of people that don't want to be told, you know, that when they're wrong, they just change the goalposts.
Yeah. Nobody. I've had a very good reaction. Both Kathleen and I have done radio shows and, have had good reactions, hosts who saying they hadn't known what to expect when they read the book, but they were very pleasantly surprised. I haven't had anybody give us a hard time. I think some people were surprised that only two chapters, one by me and one by her, dealt with flying saucers, UFOs. But there's certainly, you know, there's enough material out there to do several books, Science Was Wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is a good segue, because that's the whole point here, that when elder statesmen of science who have a number of degrees and high honors but speak out about something about which they know nothing, you can almost be certain that they're wrong. And we have many examples. And the kicker is, you know, it's not just an ego thing, but they stand in the way of progress.
Mm-hmm.
People may die because they prevent new cures, new methods of medical things. Several of the chapters in the book are about medical situations. And people are shocked a little bit. Semmelweis, Ignaz Semmelweis, one of my favorite people. He delivered babies in Austria and Vienna in the 1830s, 40s. And he figured out that the reason 20% of the women came down with childbed fever, invariably fatal, when they were taken care of by the doctors who would go from doing autopsies upstairs to delivering babies, examining women downstairs, he figured out, because a friend of his had a needle stick and, whoops, he died of the same thing. He instituted a very difficult regime. You got to wash your hands with good soap and nail brushes and stuff like that, and cut the percentage down from 20% to 3%. But the boss of the hospital said, that's not the way we do business here. You know, back then, how bloody your apron was is what decided what a good doctor you were. And they forced him out of the hospital. He published good research, had made his case. He did animal research just to back it up. How many women died?
Yeah.
And their babies. Because this strong-minded doctor said, no, not here. We're not going to do that. And, you know, there are many examples of that sort of thing. The hemophilia holocaust, which surprised some people, I guess. Doctors who said that continue using the clotting concentrate, factor VIII concentrate that you've been using all this time, this is in the early 80s, there's no danger from AIDS here. Chance of you're getting AIDS from a blood transfusion, 1 in 1,000,000.
Oh, boy.
10,000 American hemophiliacs were made HIV positive by transfusions which were contaminated. Now, it's not surprising because to make this clotting factor, they would pool several thousand units of blood and chemically treat it to get a concentrate, which is great because one little bottle has enough stuff to make up for many units of whole blood or plasma.
Mm-hmm.
The only trouble is if one unit was contaminated, the whole batch would be contaminated.
Yeah.
And the Germans had already shown a few years before that if you heat treated, you'd get rid of the hepatitis virus. But the American and Canadians said, hey, that costs too much money. It isn't necessary. Nothing to worry about. So 10,000. Now, fortunately, there were better treatments for AIDS came along.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not curable, but at least you can hold off the inevitable kind of thing. But, you know, 10,000 is a lot of people. And those guys had made an awful lot of money from hemophilia because that clotting factor isn't cheap. So it's just one more example. We found out about one guy, a Red Cross guy, who told the people, hey, we have heat-treated stuff. Send back the old stuff. They did. He sent it off to other hospitals. Would you believe that?
Oh, my God.
Well, these people have already been exposed, so it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, so when you get into technology, and that's some of the major arguments against flying saucers, you can't get here from there. You know, there's no possible way. There's no way you can fly in an airplane. Said the greatest astronomer of the 19th century, Simon Newcomb, in 1903. Everything shows, as solid as any fact can be, that man will never fly in a vehicle long distances in the air. 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. But do you know how hard it was to get financial support because of people like him saying things like that? Why would you put your money down a rat hole? Nobody's ever going to be able to fly in an airplane. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And one that cost the English a lot, an English inventor, Whittle, in 1930 got a patent for a jet engine. The English government cared not a whit. German got a patent, von Ohain, in 1935. And the Germans built the first jet-engined aircraft. Now, what if the Brits had built jet-powered aircraft and had been able to have them during the Battle of Britain? What a difference that would have made.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
You know, so there are consequences is the point. And the thing, you know, you wish people would have a big gray basket. People ask me questions, and sometimes I have to say, look, I don't know. I don't have enough data, maybe. But these guys, it's always negative. No, you can't do this. You can't do that. You won't be able to do that. And we, all of us, have to be alert to this because, you know, it's one thing to talk about childbed fever, hemophilia. These are not so common things, but there are other areas. Well, the case that I like to, well, I don't like talking about it because it sickens my stomach, frankly, but the battles against Billy Mitchell about sinking ships from airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a very successful pilot during World War One, and he came out of it saying, as an officer, saying that the warfare had been changed. Now ships would be able to—I mean, would be able to be sunk by airplanes dropping bombs on them. And Secretary of the Navy said, "I'll stand on any ship. He's going to bomb. You never sink a ship with a bomb dropped from an airplane." He got court-martialed and so forth. Well, a little piece of paper shows you what happens when you listen to people like that. On November 29th, 1941, the Army-Navy football game. And in the program, there was a picture of a huge battleship, the USS Arizona, and a statement that man has never sunk a battleship from the air. 8 days later came Pearl Harbor, and USS Arizona was sunk, killing over 1,100 men on board. The Japanese didn't know you couldn't sink a ship from an airplane.
Yeah, exactly.
We weren't prepared to defend against that, you see, because it was impossible. So there are consequences, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, it seems like history's littered with changes that were the result of ignorance, almost. It's stunning. To take you down a different path here, I wanted to, you know, I'm a big fan of the historical aspect of ufology, and I recently saw that you have spoken at more MUFON symposiums than anyone in history, which is a remarkable feat. Congratulations on that. And I guess I wanted your opinion on, you know, UFO groups in general. It seems like they're a dying facet of ufology, especially when you look back to I was talking to Rich Dolan about his book, and I can't recall the case specifically, but he listed about five UFO groups that came down to check out some case in the 1970s. You know, there was NICAP and APRO and KUFOS and MUFON. So, I mean, what do you think about this changing face of ufology where the UFO groups are really a thing of the past almost?
Well, MUFON's still going.
Mm-hmm.
And the annual symposium, I spoke at last year's too, and good attendance, a lot of people buying books, attending the sessions and stuff. There were certainly well over 600 people there. I think you're right, and I think one of the things is the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
People don't need to belong to UFO groups. They can go to the Internet and find whatever junk they want. Well, you know, I admire it as a communications tool, obviously. I don't need to address envelopes, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And I'm a lousy typist. It's very easy to correct and all that stuff. But the question of reliability and checkability and people put whatever they please on the Internet, and whether it's true or not doesn't matter. And I get people citing sources and somebody's comment from the Internet who didn't provide any evidence at all. And so, but it's comforting, you see. You can be in a chat room. You can belong to Internet talk groups. And some of these have loads of postings. That's a lot easier than going to a meeting. It's certainly a lot easier than going out to investigate something.
Yeah.
You know, just believe what somebody else tells you. So it is a bit of a problem. The funny thing is that there's growing acceptance that there's probably life all over the place out there. In other words, the astronomical stuff, finding planets, people don't realize that 60 years ago there aren't any planets out there besides in our solar system. You know, we haven't seen any. Of course, we are. Looking techniques weren't adequate to the problem at hand at that time, but so that's changed drastically. There's over, I think the last number I saw was 506, and there's going to be a lot more than that because
Absolutely, we've just
begun looking. So that's one thing that's changed. Also, we're finding not only other planets, but I'll call them solar systems, that is stars that have more than one planet around them, like ours does. And so it's beginning to look a lot like life all over the place out there. Maybe the Talmud was right. Maybe there's 8,000, 18,000 planets. But so the attitude about it, and, you know, when the Pope pipes up and says, you know, there's no reason God couldn't have made others out there. Is he getting ahead of the curve? Does he know something we don't know? You know. So the attitudes have changed drastically. And that's a good thing. There aren't nearly as many people saying, I've run across a couple saying, there's nothing in the Bible And I try to get him to read Barry Downing's book, The Bible and Flying Saucers, which indicates there's plenty of stuff in the Bible. But those people are getting fewer and fewer out there. And that's all a healthy thing. In other words, I see an enormous difference within my lifespan.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It seems that way.
Yeah. And so that's good. In other words, the young people, also technology, let's face it. Maybe they don't know about nuclear rockets, which is what I do, tell them about it. And they're shocked when I point out that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. Think about that for a minute. That's an awful lot of gas not used, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Whatever they used to use. The world has come along, and lasers, you know, the laser is 50 years old this year.
Oh, wow.
And it can do an incredible amount of stuff. You can send signals that could be seen from another star system using a laser. You can shoot down an airplane using a laser. You can drill holes in baby bottle nipples using a laser and attach retinas. And all the checkout counters, where would supermarkets be without the barcodes, which are all laser red? You know, so it's taken over our life without even thinking about it. We take it for granted. CD players, got to have a laser in there, you know. So they do illustrate something. Now, one of Friedman's mantras, a technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You're going to change how you do things. In other words, that laser is not just a better light bulb. Entirely different physics, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, things, the younger people are growing up with an entirely different environment. When I look at someone with their little phones, which can do all kinds of stuff, you know, I just shake my head. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if anybody told me that when I was their age, I'd have laughed my head off. Well, how do you do that, you know?
Oh, yeah, back then computers were like the size of a room or something like that, so.
Hey, when I worked at General Electric, you'd fill out input data sheets. This is back in the 50s. A girl would key punch them on cards. Another girl would take a box of cards and a huge reel of tape, maybe over a foot in diameter, and take it up to the special facility at another building where they had loads of air conditioning, and that computer was huge. And we paid like $500 an hour for time on the computer. And I think they had 64K memories on those stuff.
Oh, wow.
But the computer could do in a few minutes what it took somebody 3 months to do by hand. So it was a tremendous improvement. But it's the people that matter. Look, the atom bomb was designed with slide rules, you know.
Yeah. We're going to get to the listener questions in a minute. The last sort of topic I wanted to touch on here with you this year was we're losing a big player, I guess you could say, a friend of ufology in a way, Larry King, who's going off the air at the end of this coming week. So I guess reflect a little bit on your experience, you know, being on his show and working with him and you know, being interviewed by him and sort of like the contributions, if you will, to ufology that, you know, he gave us a chance when a lot of people weren't giving us a chance.
Well, that's true. And I've done a show 4 times. The first one was out in the desert.
Oh, I love that. I still remember that one. That was amazing.
That was a strange show. I went to airports after that, and a lot of people recognized me. But he gave an opportunity to speak out. Now, there were flaws with the show, as everybody knows who's watched it. They had to have a nasty, noisy negativist on. Somebody who didn't have to know anything about the subject, but it's policy of the CNN, I guess, that you got to have, like, Bill Nye, the science guy whose purpose is to deny.
I love that. That's great.
Well, you know, and I've had people tell me, they say, Stan, look, let him have him on all the time. He makes you look good. Well, I will always treasure the moment when he pointed out a page which had one line blacked out and said, these guys are all saying there's a cover-up. There's no cover-up. That's a privacy issue. It's the guy's address. Fortunately, I had my book, Flying Saucers and Science, sitting out in front of me and scrabbled through it. and found a page of the CIA UFO documents that it took me 5 years to get. And you can read 8 words on it, and everything else is blacked out. So I was able to immediately show that to the camera, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about privacy from one line. We're talking, and you can, from the NSA, if you want, you can get 160 pages where you can read one sentence and everything else is whited out.
Yeah.
But I was just lucky I had the book with me because that one picture, you know, speaks 1,000 words.
Absolutely.
And so Larry and his programs usually got replayed.
Oh, yeah.
More than once. And so, you know, I'd have people say, oh, I saw you on King the other night. I'd say, well, oh, really? And then when he describes it, I know it was a rerun of a show I've been on before. But I'll tell you, one way to measure it is that if you looked at my numbers on Amazon.com,
mm-hmm.
you know, they give you sales, relative sales numbers for your books. And boy, in 24 hours, I'd come up in the top few in UFOs and life in outer space. They got several categories within 24 hours after the show. So, again, that means somebody's putting their money where their mouth is. Clearly, it had an impact that way. And now, I'll admit, I had a guy call me and say, I almost didn't call you. I figure you're only in it for the money. I said, why do you say that? Well, I see on all those television shows. I said, well, I don't get paid for those. What do you mean you don't get paid? I don't get paid. Well, how about Larry King? He doesn't pay. He pays airfare in a hotel. He doesn't even pay for meals. Well, you showed your book on there. I said, yeah. How much did they make from having me on, from advertising on their show? And I showed it when somebody mentioned something that it was an appropriate response to.
Yeah.
And so he backed off a bit. But for anybody who's listening, to think that you get paid, they all pay me what you pay me, Tim. Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't like people to give me a hard time about something that they're wrong about.
Absolutely.
Right about, okay. But, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He'll be lost, and I suppose it's known who's going to take his place.
Pierce Morgan. British guy.
Somebody told me that, and I don't know whether his people are going to go for UFOs or not. You know, I know that there are some shows where they guarantee me that they'll have a big audience because it's UFOs, and certainly Coast to Coast does well. And so it'll be interesting to see. I should try to contact them and see if I can get my reservation in for, you know. But why don't we do a UFO show only with people who know something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah.
Impossible, but it would be nice.
Yeah, exactly. Nice but impossible. That seems to be the case.
Hey, I was on Merv Griffin twice. And
oh, wow.
They didn't have any debunkers on, surprisingly. And he was very sharp, incidentally. I really enjoyed his interviews, which surprised me because I didn't expect that. But and I was on the Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. Betty Hill and I were on, and Spiegel in New York, and there were no noisy negativists on. He was looking for information, and he got it. It was a good show.
Well, I just saw they had Michio Kaku on the Conan O'Brien show, so maybe that could be your next venue.
Well, you know, I'm going to be doing a show in a strange place with Michio Kaku. The Saudi Arabian government is having a huge conference about innovation in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, toward the end of January.
Oh, wow.
There are going to be 120 speakers, and they expect an attendance of about 800. And there is one panel that will be about innovation and UFOs. And there'll be five of us there. And Nick Pope will be there. Jacques Vallée will be there.
Oh, wow.
Myself and Michio Kaku and an Arabian that I don't know anything about. I'm going to look him up. But and they're expecting, like I said, 800 people. And I saw a little note, the cost to attend this conference, not for the speakers, thank God, is like $4,500.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And, you know, what I like about it is it's going to be a lot warmer in Saudi Arabia at the end of January than in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
That's for sure. Absolutely, yeah.
But Michio, I've done Michio's radio show a couple of times. And, you know, this it's only an hour and 15-minute panel.
Mm-hmm.
So we each get, you know, a little over 10 minutes plus discussion. But I'm very impressed by the other people who are speaking. The head of Disney is going to be there.
Oh, wow.
Former Prime Minister of England, Tony Blair. Former Prime Minister of Canada, Jean Chrétien. And a whole bunch of other people that I didn't recognize all the people, but their positions. Wheels with Boeing and IBM and places like that. They're really putting on one heck of a show. They're not going to let us sell books there, unfortunately.
Well, with the price for attendance, I don't know if they're gonna, the attendees will be able to afford any books after they get there. So,
well, I look at it the other way. If you can afford to go, you can afford to buy.
That's true, actually. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they got money to burn, these folks. Damn, that sounds like quite a show. That's another nation for you to plant your pushpin in there for.
Yeah, I've only spoken in 16 countries, Canada and the United States, but that'll be the 17th, and then March I'm doing Wroclaw, I look at it, Wroclaw, Poland.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to do a whole day with the group there, and I've been to Poland, but I've never given a UFO lecture. I gave one about nuclear methods in agriculture, if you can believe.
Oh, wow. That must have been back in the day, I assume, right?
It was in the 80s, yeah, and that was before the Iron Curtain was lifted and stuff like that. So I imagine it's changed a little bit there, but and there's a group there that going to have me on all day, and then I'm supposed to meet with a Polish officer who's going to tell me about data that they've collected about UFOs. Which might be interesting.
Yeah, sounds like it will be. Wow, so you're not slowing down at all, it sounds like, so that's good.
Well, it seems like I'm not really going slow. Oh, I'll be at a TruthCon in Atlanta the first week of February.
Nice. So you're getting out there. That's still good to hear, so it's good to know, and especially this international travel. I'm just impressed. I'm really stunned by this Saudi Arabian conference. Sounds fascinating. I'll have to look more into it.
Well, it's a long ways. And also, I was in Strasbourg, France. I'd spoken in France before, but just a month or two ago, a lot of people there for a conference. The translator apologized afterwards, saying she wasn't able to keep up with me. I have no idea what those people heard.
You've been doing this for so long, she probably wasn't ready for such a polished pro, so.
I guess that's it. That sounds good.
That's what
I should have stumbled more. You know?
There you go. All right. Well, as is the tradition here on the holiday special, we opened up the floor here to the listeners and got quite a wide variety of questions. And I sort of, as I said to you, cut my questions short a little bit this year because there were so many responses. I was just blown away by how many people responded and, you know, ranging from the scientific UFO related stuff to some more, you know, existential type stuff. So I'm interested in getting your thoughts on these.
Okay.
So we'll get going here. Most of the names are pretty normal. So, but we start out with the strangest one, which is Ich bin Albertischen. I don't even know, something German. So that's his name, and he wants to know where would you say these UFOs are coming from, assuming they're not man made.
Okay. Obviously, they don't wear license plates, and we don't have a bureau checking the driver's license. But the case of Betty and Barney Hill is the only case I know of that gives us a really good handle on where those particular aliens originated. That's from a planet around either Zeta 1 Reticuli or Zeta 2 Reticuli, and that's the constellation of Reticulum. You got to go below Florida to see. It's really a southern sky constellation. It means the net.
Mm-hmm.
And the two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, are unique in our neighborhood. I mean, I think the neighborhood's crawling with life all over the place because I don't see anything special about us. Some people would get mad at me about that, but what the heck? These two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. That's 30 times closer to each other. They're both sun-like stars, but it's 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boonies. They have next door neighbors. Secondly, that means, incidentally, from a planet around one looking at the other star, you can see it all day long, and doesn't take fancy equipment to determine that there is, that there are planets and there's life over there, the characteristics of the atmosphere. And they also are at least a billion, some say 3 billion years older than the sun, those two stars. So one would expect they might have some technology a little more advanced than we are.
Yeah.
Than ours. You know, suppose they got started 500 years before we did. It could have been 5 million, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's civilizations all over the place out there. Interstellar travel is not the big deal that some people want to make it. That doesn't mean we haven't done it. We have done it yet, but you use nuclear fusion, and there's undoubtedly something better. But let's not forget that with nuclear fusion, you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in the dumb old chemical rocket. So we're not talking it's a little better, you know, or just a mite better. 10 million times better. That's good enough for me.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds good. All right, the next question comes from Jeremy Boston. He wants to know if there has been any new evidence or research regarding UFOs that has made you reevaluate what you believe the phenomena to be.
Well, in a positive sense, sure. I mentioned earlier some of the astronomical stuff. In other words, now that we know there's planets all over the place. But I'm thinking of things like a book that's going to be out, hopefully by the end of the year, in which I will be writing the foreword for, by Scott Ramsey and his wife Suzanne, about the Aztec incident, Aztec, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that's had a bad rap from all kinds of people over the years, people who didn't do any research. These guys, the two of them, Suzanne and Scott, have done an enormous amount of research, spent a ton of money. And I've read chunks of the book already, and that was a very solid case on March 28th, 1948. And that's going to shock a lot of people. And, you know, one is unusual if you got at least two. I guess these things are dropping out of the sky hither and yon. That means we've had one for some time. This was an intact one, you understand.
Interesting, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that has helped. And then the space astronomy, all that sort of stuff, makes you even more certain that life is commonplace out there, and we're not the big shots we like to think we are.
Okay, the next one comes from Vamp Elvis, and he says, and I'm not going to correct this one because I actually have a slight follow-up question to this one. He says, I would like to know if Dr. Friedman has examined the electrical model of the universe in an in-depth manner, and if so, does he find the theory compelling in manner, suggesting that it may challenge our current model of cosmology, or if he would liken it to an interested theoretical exercise with no practical application, or has he reached some other conclusion? And the follow-up I had first was, how often do you get called Dr. Friedman? Probably constantly.
Too often, yeah. And I, you know, you mentioned Larry King earlier. When I did that first show out in the desert, he introduced me as a doctor, and I said, no, he's the doctor. Steve Gerr was there. I'm just the physicist, only a master's degree. Sorry, in industry, you don't need to have a PhD. I mean, pile higher and deeper. Who needs it? You know.
Exactly. I use that line all the time myself. So.
But, no, I can't say I've looked at the electrical theory of the universe. On the other hand, there's a chapter in Science Was Wrong about the electrical influences in the solar system. The solar storms, the cosmic rays, the energy coming from Jupiter, and their influence not only on our planet, but on the people. You know, Dr. Becker, who was able to correlate admissions to veterans' mental hospitals with the Earth's electric field, which shakes up some people. Emanuel Velikovsky and his predictions. So, yes, and also in the chapter on so-called global warming, it's given man way too much credit. The climate changes up, down, backwards, forwards, whatever you want.
Yeah.
But don't give man the credit for changing it. CO2 isn't even the biggest by far of the greenhouse gases. Water vapor is, and there are others that are more important than CO2. So we'd like to think how powerful we are, and the rich countries should give, what are they talking yesterday in Cancun, $100 billion to make up to the poor companies about the need for a low-carbon emission. Balderdash! It's garbage. So, yeah, electricity is much more important in the universe, electrical forces, plasma physics, all that sort of thing, than had been given credit for in the past.
Okay.
We need more work.
That seems to be the case across the board. We need more work on all this stuff. All right, now G Wiz wants to know, with all the new info about hypnosis, and he's referencing this Emma Woods controversy that's erupted lately, do you feel that it is still a valid tool? And if so, why? And if not, do you have any suggestions to help move this area of investigation forward?
Well, certainly the Emma Woods business is a pain in the butt and shouldn't have happened. And I don't know what got into David Jacobs to do so many sessions over the phone, long distance. I don't like it one little bit. It's no better or worse than the guy who's doing it. The thing about the Betty and Barney Hill case, for example, is described in the book Captured by myself and Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece, who has all the tapes and has transcribed them all and so forth, is that Dr. Simon knew nothing about flying saucers, but he knew an awful lot about helping people find what happened during lost time, usually shell shock war veterans. He ran a hospital that had 3,000 beds for guys from World War II. And, you know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. That can leave an impression, a bad one. And so hypnosis, when properly done, can be very useful. When badly done, it can do harm. And that's unfortunate. And we do need to remember that roughly 30% of abductees remember the experience without hypnosis. But I'll tell you, one of the debunkers said, oh, Betty, Barney was excited under hypnosis, but Betty sounded like somebody taking a walk through the supermarket. Well, I don't know where he's getting that from, but I'll tell you, I've listened to some of those tapes, and if you listen to the tapes and read the transcriptions, that was no supermarket. Dr. Simon had to stop one session each of them because he wasn't sure that they could handle the absolute terror as they relived, not retold, relived what happened to them. So hypnosis by itself is neutral. It depends on who's using it. It can be very effective, can do a lot of good. It can do some harm. It's kind of like, you know, police have used it to recover the license plate of a car that a cop sees driving away when his buddy just got shot. Yeah. He's worried about his buddy. And he sees the license plate, but he's not paying attention because there are other things going on. Okay, if you take him back and have him relive that peacefully, you know, like you're seeing it on the screen or something, it's amazing how accurate the recall can be, and that gives you the license plate of the car. Now, you need more than that, obviously, like a bullet hole in the trunk would help.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But it is useful. It has been used to help in stopping smoking and stopping eating, you know. So it depends on the practitioner and the rules which he lives by to do it. And Simon was a number one.
Now, do you think in light of this whole Emma Woods thing that we need to reevaluate a lot of the information that abduction research has been built on over the last, like, couple decades?
Well, I don't know that we need to be cautious, let's put it that way. And we need to watch what conclusions we draw from it. Remember that we're dealing with people who are fallible observers.
Mm-hmm.
You got observation and interpretation. And so you've got to be really careful about the conclusions you draw from these things. And so it is a useful tool when used properly by skilled people. I'll tell you, quick little experience. I once took a course on hypnosis many, many years ago, a medical possibility for somebody in the family. The teacher put one of the girls under and had her go back in time And she starts talking like a younger person and all that stuff. And he takes her back. He thought he was on safe ground to her 8th birthday. And she burst into tears. Turns out her father had died on her 8th birthday.
Oh, God.
And so I was so glad he was there to deal with that, to get her out of that without doing damage to her. You don't want her to relive the anguish of her father's death, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So you need somebody who's skilled and who has training in, I'll call it psychology, the social sciences, if you will. And not everybody who does it has that kind of training. It's an unfortunate thing. It will get in the way, no question about it. Hopefully it will keep some people from doing what they shouldn't have done in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. The next question comes from Orpheus. He says, being that you seem to take a somewhat more practical approach to UFOs and their research, do you ever find it difficult to deal with the more fringe aspects of ufology, and has that ever impeded your research in any way?
Well, you know, it depends what you mean by fringe aspects. I consider the nasty, noisy negativists a fringe aspect, and that's a pain in the neck. Yeah, the fringe aspects do get in the way. I haven't really been impeded. And usually, if I've looked into the subject matter at hand, I can give an opinion based on having looked at it. And it doesn't bother me to say, no, I've checked on that. Well, you know, you got Bob Lazar. I just had a guy try to give me a hard time about him. It sounds like you're jealous of him. Surely, you know, he's got something good to offer and so forth. So I went in the chapter and verse of the research that I did.
Mm-hmm.
Which he obviously hadn't been aware of. So fringe aspects are a pain in the neck. The cult groups, you know, who want to make gurus out of people, it is a pain in the neck. But it's the price you pay. What can I say? That, you know, we're dealing with social sciences. We consider a guy a very good baseball player if he gets a hit 35% of the time. He gets paid a lot of money to do that.
Yeah.
We don't say he's a lousy player because 65% of the time he doesn't even get a hit, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
So you put up with, as Goodman Ace used to say, with the bitter, or his wife, with the bitter with the batter or something like that. It goes along with the territory. We're dealing with human beings. We're not dealing with machines.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems, if anything, it would seem like the fringe aspects would, unfortunately, like just co-opt your stuff to bolster their fringe arguments, whether it's with Roswell or with MJ-12, you know.
They get mad at me. And, you know, I consider, frankly, and some people get mad at me for saying this, the opposition to the three primary MJ-12 documents, the Eisner briefing document, the Cutler Twining memo, and the Truman Forrestal memo, it sounds to me fringy to me. I keep trying to get people to say, the objectors, what is it about these documents that makes you think they're phony? I've dealt with a whole slew of these supposed attributes in Top Secret Magic and in a 4-part article, long one, on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. What argument can you make that isn't rebutted by my detailed investigation? And nobody gives me answers, darn it. So I consider that fringy. Everybody, I mean, what is a line like, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent except you, Friedman. That's not useful.
Yeah.
Why are they fraudulent? You know, why did Phil Klass pay me $1,000 for proving him wrong about the typeface on one of them?
Mm-hmm.
He told everybody about challenging me, nobody about paying me, incidentally. The check is in the book, Flying Saucers and Science.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't recommend that book enough. That's a must-have and a must-read. A perfect gift, actually, since we're in the holiday episode here. Perfect gift for your friends and family, you know, who are trying to understand why the hell you're interested in this crazy UFO subject. That'll straighten them out.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas!
This just in, Santa Claus is dead.
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special, featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays!
It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer, we smile a little easier, we share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be. Have a Merry Christmas. everybody.